To order, because we don't have a quorum, but let's begin the process. We have Representative Paul Anderson with the bill, House File 1298, which is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. So with that introduction, Representative Anderson, would you like to introduce your bill?
Mr. Chair, I think somebody would have to introduce the bill for me, or have you done that yet?
I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Schumacher moves House File 1296 to be laid over for possible inclusion to the omnibus health bill.
I couldn't have picked a better choice. Anyway, thanks, Mr. Chair and members. We'll go slow here for a couple of minutes. House File 1296 relates to an organization back up in Sauk Center called the Eagles Healing Nest, and they've been in operation for a couple of years and working with veterans in the area. And Stearns County has done an outstanding job of working with the Eagles Nest and helping them obtain GRH funding in a whole variety of other ways. And Stearns County would like to be reimbursed for some of the funds that they've expended for helping get the Eagles Healing Nest program going in terms of the GRH funding and such. And Mr. Chair, I have Stearns County representative here to discuss the reasons behind the bill. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sizer. I'm the Human Services Administrator for Stearns County. Human Services in Stearns County provides corrections, public health, and social services. We have been involved in providing services to Eagles Healing Nest for over a year in their Sauk Center location. They currently have about 60 residents and have opened a third building, which will give them a capacity of 70. If they do open all the buildings that are serviceable, they could have as many as 200 residents at the Eagles Healing Nest. It is somewhat unique. Most GRH facilities are 2, 6, 8-bed facilities. As we look at 70 beds, it creates some unique challenges for us. Also, a lot of the residents at the facility are from out of county, and they also have residents from out of state. I would like to just highlight briefly four areas of services that Stearns County is providing. First is financial services. And as an example, we determine group residential housing eligibility, financial assistance eligibility, and we provide case management for those individuals. GRH funding has been approved for Eagles Healing Nest. We do the eligibility reviews. The monthly tasks include approving and releasing those payments and then case managing those cases. The next area that we're involved in is providing all of the social services to Eagles Healing Nest. Many residents that arrive there are experiencing chemical dependency issues, mental health issues. We provide those chemical dependency screenings and Rule 25 assessments. Detox services are also being utilized by this population, and our daily per diem at detox is now at $340 a day. Services we also are involved with our adult mental health, vulnerable adult protection, civil commitment, and disability services. The third area is providing correctional services, and this is the most expensive, almost $60,000 annually. A number of residents are ordered to be on probation, supervised release, or pretrial supervision, and are currently living at Eagles Healing Nest. We average about 10, 15 to 20 of the individuals at the facility under some type of supervision. And many are on probation or supervised release in other counties, and those counties periodically will be contacting us to transfer supervision to Stearns County. Many of those are high-risk individuals, and they require intensive supervision services. We have a domestic violence, felony repeat domestic violence court in Stearns County. A number of them are supervised under that program. We also have a repeat DWI program that requires intensive supervision. The final area is our Veteran Benefits and Services. Our county veteran services officers provide outreach to the facility on a monthly basis. They also see residents regularly in our Melrose, Minnesota satellite office. Since many of these individuals have lived a fairly transient lifestyle and have no permanent housing, the amount of counseling to develop a claim for veteran services can be very extensive. One claim may require one visit, and that claim is completed. Others may require records from the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, medical records, statements from fellow veterans, ship's logs, etc. Record requests are required in writing, so letters have to be sent, and then those claims processed. It turns out to be a pretty extensive workload for our veteran services officers. Looking at clerical and supervisory costs at 3%, commitment holds, detox, drug testing, and mileage, as well as some administrative overhead, the cost to the county in 2013 was $89,384. The bill is requesting a grant through DHS in the amount of $85,000 per year over the next biennium. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sizer. Representative Anderson. Any other testifiers?
No, I don't have any, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. And notice that Representative Schumacher would like to move the minutes from March 24th. Are there any additions or subtractions, corrections to those? Seeing none, all those for approval of the minutes of March 24th, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are adopted. And Representative Anderson, to your bill, questions from members. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I remember very well when Representative Abler brought this about this facility, and we had a lot of discussion about it, and I remember having the testimony from some of the folks that stay there and the woman who runs it, and it's certainly a very worthy cause, and obviously it does a lot of great work. And here I think we're hearing the other side of that, because as I remember, originally the county was resistant to having this be or approving it for group residential housing or something of that nature, and we can kind of see why, not for any lack of goodwill, but just because obviously this is an expensive population with a lot of needs, as we've seen in other places. But I'm sure that we want to meet those needs. I mean, these are veterans. They, we try to serve veterans as best we can. In a lot of settings, we don't always do such a great job. And this is very worthy. But my question is, I was kind of making notes as the gentleman was speaking about the various kinds of things that the county has to provide to support this population. And I'm kind of surmising from this that the facility, because it offers these kind of services, is probably attracting people into the county that you wouldn't otherwise be serving. Maybe you could confirm that for me. But my real question is, how can you do this for only $85,000 a year? It just sounds like this has got to be, I mean, I think that's actually tremendously resourceful if that's true, because of the numbers of people and how needy this population can be.
Mr.
Sizer.
Thank you. Yes, it does pull in many of the residents from outside of Stearns County, and there are at times residents from out of state. So this is a population that may not have normally come to Stearns County to seek services. We have a finance division in our department that really gets right down to the penny of what these services are costing based on hours of social workers, probation officers, financial workers, etc. And the $89,000 was a 2013 cost. As that population grows, I anticipate those costs will grow proportionately as well.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am understanding from that you're being conservative in your cost estimate here, and you're just you're not coming in and asking for $2 and $3 million to do something grandiose, understanding that it'll be cut back in the end. You're saying this is really what our costs were, and it's probably even a little more, but this is what you feel would just meet the need for now. Is that kind of the right characterization of that?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, that is the actual cost for 2013.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Sizer, I've been to that facility and seen it up close, and you do really, really great work at that particular facility. And it struck me as when I saw the sign-up sheets and the monthly calendar for all of the volunteer work, it just seemed like the intensity around the volunteer work was probably because it needed to get done. But it also seemed very like a good thing. I mean, we're a big-hearted state, really want to volunteer, and particularly this was very well organized. Has there been any documentation about just how many hours per year that we are volunteering at that particular facility?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. One clarification is it's a private nonprofit, 501c3, and Ms. Butler does run that facility. The county doesn't run it or really have any capacity to do that. Our services are providing services for those clients in residence there. She does not have any paid staff. That's one real unique thing about Eagles Healing Nest. All of the staff throughout the day are volunteers. Also, anyone in the evening or weekends is on a volunteer basis. With that number of residents, they also have a peer, I don't know quite how to say it, veterans serving veterans. So those that are in residence longer take on leadership roles and take on some of the supervision, the direction going on at the facility. I would guess it's a few thousand hours a month that is going into that facility in volunteer hours.
And it was just my just kind of my impression that but for that extremely well-organized staff of volunteers that those duties would have been taken up by somebody either through one of our programs or the county or somebody, but it did seem a little unorthodox and in a good way, but you could see that they were taking up the work of others. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, that's a good characterization. We like to say it's outside of the box. It's attracting some national attention. There's going to be some national news people there next week to do some filming, talking with veterans. And this place ran on donated time and money for a couple of years. Now they're getting more established. They're actually purchasing the property. And the GRH funding was a great help in getting that done. So the help we can give them in helping veterans to help other veterans would be very much appreciated, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Anderson. So we didn't officially move the bill. Representative Schumacher, would you like to move House File 1296? Be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. All right. Representative Schumacher moves House File 1296 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. There are no amendments to this bill. There are no other questions. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House File 1296 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative. And thank you, Mr. Sizer, for coming down to
the testimony. Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
All right, next up we have House File 607 with Representative Tice. Please come on forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will go ahead and move House File 607, and that will be recommended to be referred to the General Register. Representative Tice, the bill is now before us. Do you have any amendments to House File 607?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. None as far as I am either. So, House File 607 is before us. Representative Tice, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am honored to be here today to bring forward House File 607. I door-knocked a lot of homes in the past several years, and the one question I got most frequently was regarding my pro-life stance. I believe it is my duty to represent my constituency in challenging and changing our current law. I believe that the one place to start is with this bill. My folks are not happy spending their hard-earned money on elective procedures because the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe v. Gomez ruling. Taxpayer-funded abortions have swelled to 34.8% of all abortions performed in the state, according to the Minnesota Department of Health. It is unfortunate that taxpayer-funded abortions have been on the rise in Minnesota in the recent years. As an advocate for my constituents, it is my duty to make some changes. The reason we're here today is that there was a fiscal note requested, and I believe that you should have that. So with that, I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Tice. I understand you have several testifiers. The first testifier is Andrea Rao from MCCL. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I recognize you have a very full agenda today, so I'll just be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. If you'd be available to answer questions, the next one, testifier that we have is Reverend Abigail Henderson. No takers. Next up, please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Abigail Henderson. I'm an ordained minister serving First United Church of Christ in Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm also here representing the Minnesota chapter of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. And I'm speaking hoping that my testimony will remind members that the religious voice in Minnesota is not united against abortion. My words reflect a wide range of values of people of faith and clergy in Minnesota. And my faith has led me to believe that all women deserve the right of self-determination over their bodies. I pray to a God who stands with people when they are suffering and when they are faced with difficult decisions, including women who make the decision to end a pregnancy. And I have arrived at this position through careful prayer, discernment, and conversation with people that I trust, and I trust other women to do the same when they consider how, when, and if to bear children. And I cannot support HF 607 because it prohibits state-sponsored health plans from providing abortion coverage. And I understand that the writers and supporters of this bill do not want tax dollars going toward abortion. As a tax-paying person of faith, I know that I don't always agree with the way the government spends my money. But if we truly believe in the separation of church and state, then we cannot limit the reproductive options of low-income women based on the religious objections of some people. I don't believe it's the government's role to make such important personal and intimate decisions on behalf of any women. And whether this legislation passes or not, I know that privileged women will continue to exercise their constitutional right to abortion, and my faith leads me to believe that low-income women on state-sponsored health insurance deserve the same. So I urge the committee to consider religious freedom and protect all women's dignity as you consider this bill, and I thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Next up, we have Andrea Ledger. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will keep my testimony brief. My name is Andrea Ledger. I am the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. We represent approximately 60,000 Minnesotans statewide and work on issues around reproductive rights and freedom. I'm here in opposition to this bill. In the real world, unfortunately, restrictions on abortion access don't eliminate abortion, but they can push women to make that decision later in pregnancy or push abortion out of reach altogether. Low-income women often have difficulty raising the money to pay for abortion care, and research indicates that economic barriers often cause them to obtain abortion care 2 to 3 weeks later in pregnancy than wealthier women. This is especially problematic because the cost of abortion increases the longer the pregnancy continues. When a woman is living paycheck to paycheck, denying coverage for an abortion can push her deeper into poverty. And studies show that women who seek an abortion but are denied are 3 times more likely to fall into poverty than women who are able to get an abortion. When it comes to the most important decisions in life, like whether to become a parent, it's vital that a woman be able to consider all her options, including an abortion, no matter what her income or source of insurance. A woman facing an unintended pregnancy should not have to make her health decisions based on whether she has enough money. It should be based on what's best for her health and for her family. If abortion coverage is available to some, it should be available to all, and it is available legally to all. Simply put, we shouldn't treat some women's health needs differently than others just because of the type of insurance they have. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Karen Law? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee. My name is Karen Law, and I'm the Executive Director of Pro-Choice Resources, a reproductive justice organization focused on grassroots advocacy and healthcare access. For over 48 years, Pro-Choice Resources has served Minnesota women and their families. Clergy and doctors founded our organization as they believe all women should be treated with dignity and respect. Our mission is to ensure that all people in communities have the power and resources to make sexual and reproductive health decisions with self-determination and dignity. We believe that access to reproductive health care is a basic human right. I'm here today to speak in opposition of House File 607. We know that the majority of Minnesotans want our representatives to treat people with respect and believe that a woman, not politicians, should make the informed decisions when it comes to her own pregnancy. Yet House File 607 purposely interferes with a woman's personal decision-making. For many, coverage for abortion care means the difference between getting the health care they need and being denied that care. We should not create burdens and restrictions that deny health care coverage for someone who is eligible and qualified for Medicaid just to make it impossible for her to have an abortion. Restricting Medicaid coverage of abortion forces 1 in 4 poor women to carry an unplanned pregnancy to term. I do not understand why we push for these bans when we know these bans will harm Minnesota's most vulnerable women and families. It seems unfair, unjust, and discriminatory. There is a misconception that these bills have been put forth to protect women and are in the best interest of our community. Sadly, this couldn't be further from the truth. These bills are thinly veiled pieces of legislation designed to create additional barriers to abortion and push this health service out of reach for poor women. At Pro-Choice Resources, we know that communities and families thrive when women are able to make the decisions that are best for themselves and their families. Every day we hear from women who are struggling to make ends meet and who are often overlooked and or misrepresented when it comes to the politics of abortion. These women are seeking resources for basic health care. Pregnancy happens in the broader context of our lives, and only the woman knows the full story and circumstances around her decision. We talk to women like Becky. Becky's a 35-year-old mother of 2 children. She has a job where she works 12-hour shifts, but she's never guaranteed a set number of hours per week. It shouldn't matter whether Becky has private or government-funded health insurance. She should have coverage for a full range of pregnancy-related health care, including abortion, if she needs it. It's important to provide provide insurance coverage to ensure that women will be able to see a licensed, quality health care provider and receive safe care if we truly want to protect and help the women in Minnesota. It makes sense to me that health programs for women with low incomes cover birth control and abortion, not just childbirth, because when people can plan if and when to have children, it's good for them and for our community as a whole. I urge this committee to oppose House File 607. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Law. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the testimony at this time and open it up to member questions and comments. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is this bill being referred to?
The General Register.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the chair, for the author. Has anybody talked about the need for this bill to go to the Commerce Committee? It appears from the language that it talks about state-sponsored health programs, and I think that that is a broader statement than just our public assistance programs, but actually could impact CGIP, impact PEEP. And so for that reason, it really should be seen in the Commerce Committee as well.
Other comments? Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, could the perhaps the author could respond if she's talked to the chair of the Commerce Committee or talked about that path at all?
Sure. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hubbardston, I have not.
Mr. Chair, because of the need for us to have oversight over our state programs for employees through PEEP and CGIP, I'd like to move that we re-refer this to the Commerce Committee.
All right. Representative Halverson moves a re-referral to the Commerce Committee.
And, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call, please.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, point of information. Don't we have to vote on the bill to pass before we entertain a motion to no?
Representative Grunhagen, the current motion that is before us is a re-referral to the General Register made by me. In order to change that, we would have to vote to change the referral. That is what is currently up for debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Other discussion? Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, are there any restrictions on vasectomies under state-sponsored plans?
Representative Schoen, I think that probably goes to the bill. Our debate is going to be on the Halverson motion to re-refer.
I got bill discussion. Sorry.
Oh, boom.
Let me know when we're doing that.
I will not forget. All right.
I got more.
Further discussion on the re-referral, there is a roll call. I would just say that in looking at the bill, this bill has been heard in the policy committee as well. And here where we cover our public programs and what is covered, not covered on public programs, that's the purview of this committee. So I would recommend that it not go to the Commerce Committee. The chair of the Commerce Committee has not asked for this bill. Representative Liebling. Oh, I'm sorry. Woffler, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if Representative Keel could clarify the intent of her bill, because the language is very unclear as to the intended audience, whether it's simply people on medical assistance or it's a more broader definition of state-funded health programs. Because whether that would influence what committee it should go to. And
thank you, Representative Woffler. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just talking to Ms. Rowe about that, and she's going to take this one.
Ms. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Rao, and I'm representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. This bill has been before the legislature many times in the past and has gone through the committee process many times as well. It has never been referred to Commerce. None of the Commerce chairs in the past have requested it. And my recollection, although I can't recall the exact definition, but I seem to believe that there is a definition somewhere in statute that does specify exactly which programs would be covered under this. And maybe if somebody from the department or elsewhere knows that for certain.
Perhaps Ms. Olson, if you might have a comment on that, on the little bit about a history of that. If not, I believe we have had both federal and state prohibitions on funding within our programs, from the federally with the Hyde Amendment, and also within our state-based programs. We have clarified that within our legislation for legislative intent in the past. So we have spelled that out within our program definitions in the past.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling. Flopless, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think no matter what the topic of a bill is, we need to know what we're influencing, whose lives we're impacting, whose life choices we're narrowing or expanding. And it's just good form for us to understand if this is just people who are enrolled in state subsidized health programs like medical assistance or MinnesotaCare, or if we're looking much more broadly to employee benefits. It has a much broader, bigger scope. If we are talking about the public employees insurance program, where we're talking about local governments, who none of whom have come before us to, and I suspect do not understand that they may be impacted by this, but would pay attention if it was sent to the Commerce Department, the Commerce Committee, where they do pay attention to employee provisions that is typically in the jurisdiction of that committee. And so to me it's important before it goes to the floor that those who are impacted, whether you support it or oppose this, have fair notice of, you know, who we're talking about and who's impacted, because this may have implications for budgets beyond our own, local government budgets. It may have implications for contract relationships, vendor relationships with the health plans, for self-insured plans. And so it really does, I mean, I think it's good for us to know the scope, and I think it would be, since we're the author, Representative Tice, and her witness prefer the current language, that I think we do need to send it then to the Commerce Department, who can, or the Commerce Committee, because they will be able to interpret what we can't in this committee, because it's not our purview to decide whether this language refers to the insurance packages provided to school district employees, city employees through the public employees insurance pool, or whether it applies to our state employees through the CGIP program.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I just direct you to lines 1.6 and 1.7 of the bill. Funding for state-sponsored health programs shall not be used for funding abortions except to the extent necessary for continued participation in a federal program. I believe that's the identical language that we have carried in the bill in the past. It's fairly clear. Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that whether or not we've carried this exact language in the past, I don't think is really relevant to the question before us, which is even our House research staff don't know what this language means. And I think it is very important when we're taking away women's choices, that we at least know which women we are taking choices away from. And Representative Tice introduced the bill by talking about how abortions, publicly funded abortions, have increased, I guess as a proportion, because I do believe that the number of abortions has been dropping over the years. Everybody's nodding. That's right. I think we could all agree that's a good thing. But she's perhaps intending this only to take choices away from poor women, when in fact it may take choices away from every woman sitting around this table who's a state employee, and a lot of other state employees. So I think if we're going to take choices away from women and say, women on Medicaid are in a little different situation. Obviously, those are taxpayer-provided. But it's also taxpayer-provided resources for those of us who have state insurance through our job. Although I suppose that those of us who have that would say we've earned that, and it's part of our compensation, and we should be able to make our own choices with what we have earned. So if we're going to, if you want to pass a bill, Mr. Chair, that takes away women's choices, I think we should at least know women in Minnesota, not even we, but the women who may be watching, who should be paying attention, need to know if you are taking away their choices or only somebody else's choices. And that is a very important consideration. This bill needs to go to Commerce. It needs to be vetted about which programs it impacts, and as Representative Loeffler laid out, what the impacts may be on all of the state-sponsored health programs. So, members, I urge you to vote yes on Representative Halverson's motion.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on Representative Loeffler's question, Representative Keough, I'm wondering if you can comment regarding the, Tice. We're all mixing up each other's names today.
We can ask her
too. If you could comment on the legislative intent regarding the language state-sponsored health programs. Are you intending that this only impact people who are on public assistance programs? Are you intending this language to be broader and hit the employed population of the state as well?
Representative Tice.
The intent is basically to take a program that uses taxpayer monies to fund it. So, you know, I think it's very specific. We're looking at taxpayer dollars and where they're being used.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halvers.
To that point, then, it is very clear that we will also be talking about the employed population who are on state-sponsored programs such as CGIP and PEEP. So that just confirms that we need this to go to the Commerce Committee and fix any potential confusion in the future. We can certainly make that language more clear in the Commerce Committee so we understand the path and why it's there and exactly what the legislative intent is of this language. So I urge you to vote yes on my motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Roll call having been requested. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dean?
No.
Vice Chair McDonald?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Allen? Representative Backer?
No.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Greenhagen?
No.
Representative Halvorsen?
Yes.
Representative Hamilton? Representative Lane?
Yes.
Representative Lomer?
No.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Aye.
Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Schoen?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Zuros?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The referral will remain to the General Register. Representative Tice, to your bill. Other questions? Sorry. We had Schoen next. Sorry. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sorry, I was a little bit out of order there earlier. Do we put any restrictions on vasectomies in the same fashion that your bill would currently on women's health care issues?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen. I am not aware of anything right now. This bill just specifically talks about this subject.
Okay. Do you know anywhere? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Do we, if you're in a state-sponsored plan, do we cover medication for erectile dysfunction currently?
Representative Schoen, who are you directing the question?
To the author. Do we have any restrictions on erectile medication dysfunction in state health care plans?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen. I don't know.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, you know, I'll tell you why I oppose this bill, is that as it comes to sperm, erections, and testicles, we don't get into that issue. But when it comes to women's health care issues, in a more guided religious discussion, that's where we don't seem to be bothered by the separation of church and state. Now, I may personally go to my church and say I'm not a, would rather abortions didn't happen, but I also understand the difference between what we're doing here inside this building as it pertains to the decisions my daughter may have to make as it relates to her health care. Now, I don't want anybody dealing with my male reproductive issues in state law, if they should ever happen. And I don't know why we would do that to women in state law. A lot of things happen in your own personal life and make your own personal decisions at church or otherwise. And I think that's where that belongs. This doesn't belong in state law.
Representative Liebling.
Oh, I didn't know I was on the list, but thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have to think about it, and I'm on the list. So
always on my mind.
That's the idea. So, Representative Tice, I'm interested in this clause on 1.7 that starts on 1.7, except to the extent necessary for continued participation in a federal program. So what is the extent that would be necessary for continued participation in a federal program? To what extent does the state have to use its state funding for abortions to maintain participation? What federal programs are we talking about here?
Ms. Trump.
Well, Mr. Chair, I asked the author.
Oh, I'm
is
sorry.
The author not?
Representative Tice, if you'd like to answer, it looks like Ms. Rao, who is an expert in this area, she could probably follow up. Representative Tice, if you'd like to respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make sure that the information is correct, I would like to ask Ms. Rao to answer that one.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, members of the committee, as it states in the fiscal note as well, we are talking about specifically about the Medicaid program and the Hyde Amendment that is done annually on the federal level, which prohibits paying for abortions except for cases of saving the life of the mother and in cases of rape and incest. So we would continue to fund abortions in those cases as required.
So, Mr.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So, Representative Tice, are there definitions somewhere in Minnesota law of what those things mean then? What is required then? If a woman says she's raped and she goes to her doctor, supposing this became law, a woman on Medicaid is raped, she goes to her doctor, say she goes to a Planned Parenthood clinic, what is the procedure supposed to be to determine that she was raped? Or is it now that everybody would get around this by saying I was raped?
Representative Tice.
You know, what this bill will do, will just continue to follow the federal guidelines, which is spelled out in the Hyde, mm-hmm. in the Hyde guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Representative Tice. It seems to me then that you're asking this committee to pass a bill without understanding what its operation really is. How is it really going to work in Minnesota? Just telling us, we'll do whatever is in the federal law is not much of an answer. This bill, other than the severability clause, which seems to be just boilerplate on every abortion bill, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 lines in this bill. This is as important as Ms. Rao is around this body, she's not a member. And I think it's really incumbent on you to be able to tell this committee how this stuff is supposed to work. Because right now we know how it works in Minnesota, and it works pretty well. And to say then that we're going to now interpreting the federal law, and the federal law is going to govern, I think is not doesn't really help us very much here, because I want to know how, if this thing would become law, how would a rape victim show that she's a rape victim? Or, God forbid, a victim of incest. What is she going to have to do to show that she's entitled to have a state-paid abortion? So we're going to take away women's choices. We're also going to put them through some procedure if, God forbid, they should have one of these things happen and need help for that reason. We're going to put them through some unknown procedure that you are coming to this committee and not even able to tell us what that would consist of. So I guess that's more of a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tice, are you aware that in 1995 the Minnesota Supreme Court considered this exact proposal or very similar wording and found that it violates our Minnesota Constitution and the right to privacy as it's defined in the Minnesota Constitution?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, yes, I am.
And Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tice, then, why do you feel the need to bring forward something that we have already had our highest court of Minnesota determine is unconstitutional?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, because my district, when I was talking to folks, as I said, the question that comes up most often for me is, how do I stand on pro-life issues? And they are not happy with the way the Minnesota law is, and they wanted to challenge it. Yes, they're aware of what is happening, but I also know that only 17 states in the United States have laws like Minnesota. And I'm willing to take on the challenge to basically do just that, challenge it, because I don't think everyone in Minnesota really approves of where the taxpayer dollars are going.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Loeffler,
and Representative Tice, going to through the court process, through all the levels up to the Supreme Court, is not an inexpensive process. It requires the involvement of a lot of attorney general time, a lot of preparation, and the fiscal note does note that that's a likely outcome, that we would have a court challenge, and I don't see a fiscal note from the Attorney General's office estimating what that would be, and I would think that that would be something that this committee would want to put in. As I understand it, state agencies are responsible for funding the Attorney Generals that service them and defend them against lawsuits, and so I think, Mr. Chair, that we need a fiscal note from the Attorney General's office on the estimated cost of the litigation, since it is almost guaranteed that this will go through the court process, and the author has indicated that that is her intent.
Representative Loeffler, I'm not aware of us really designing in costs for court cases that haven't happened yet, so I wouldn't expect that. Representative,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
it would be anticipated that this would happen within the next 2 years, the biennium for which this committee is going to prepare the budget. And so I really do believe that that is a cost associated with the bill, that this committee is responsible for anticipating and legislation it brings forward.
Appreciate that. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Tice, for bringing this important legislation forward. Tice. Mm-hmm. I sincerely appreciate it. My basis for supporting this is twofold, but, Norma McCorvey was the Jane Roe in the 1973 Supreme Court decision. She has now, many years later, become pro-life. And in her words, she said the Supreme Court, the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision is no longer valid because scientific and anecdotal evidence has come to light in the last 30 years that has shown the negative effects of abortion. So the fact is, from a medical and scientific standpoint, we know now what we didn't know in 1973, that life begins at conception. So unlike erectile function or a vasectomy, all right, we're talking about a human life from conception. That is a settled medical and scientific fact. Once you introduce life into the womb, then treating it as non-life and as some other type of a medical procedure is simply irrational from my standpoint. So I strongly support the bill. I thank you for bringing it forward and look forward to voting it for it on the House floor.
All right. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd make two comments. One, we usually have the stereotypical view of a young girl in a situation that, you know, she doesn't really know when we need to help her. But, in fact, many abortions are had by mature adult mothers for whom this is a decision about the family, a family decision, a family choice. It's a private family choice. And which brings me to my other comment about the first testifier, religious freedom. I believe that the belief regarding what Representative Grunhagen just mentioned is actually a religious view. I personally have strong religious beliefs and supported by my faith in my church, and I need to stand for religious freedom in this. I don't want politicians interfering with the private religious beliefs of me and others, making religious beliefs imposed on others. This is a very, very a dangerous place for politicians to go in imposing religious beliefs on others.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tice, I'm just very, very grateful that you brought this bill forward today. I, like you, have very many constituents that are very, very troubled by the fact that their dollars pay to end the life of an unborn child. And these people are religious as well. And I'm very grateful, and I, too, look forward to supporting your bill. So thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to revisit, if I may, some of the language that Representative Liebling was talking about. And my question, I'm looking at the research brief here, is this the Hyde Amendment language and what it means? And I trust somebody's going to know what this language means if we've been down this road how many times talking about this bill and others that have this language. So I'm looking at where a woman's life is at risk. And does that life is fairly clear to the author, if I may, Mr. Chair. Does that include health in that determination of a woman's life at risk, such as her mental health? Do we know that?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell. I don't believe it does. I believe it has to do with instances where a mother develops gestational diabetes or high blood pressure, things like that. And I would say they're more immediate life-threatening measures. That is what the Hyde Amendment talks about.
Representative Purcell.
So that concerns me because I know we're hearing a bill here in a little while, a 1062 that talks about mental health crisis services, and certainly, you know, we're beginning to get a hold of the fact that the head's connected to the rest of the body, and treating the brain and our mental health as part of our human body. So I'm concerned if that wouldn't be part of the interpretation that the life and health of the woman would be considered here. So that alone would bring me to oppose this.
All right, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. First, a question for the author of the bill, for Representative Tice. And I'm asking this question to make sure I understand your aim here. Because as I listened to you speak, it sounded to me that you're carrying this legislation because you have constituents who want to see a law change. And as I understand this issue, the court has made a decision. And so if this bill were to become law, it would be found my current understanding, it would be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, are you bringing this legislation to trigger a court challenge with the Minnesota Supreme Court? Is that your actual aim?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, my intent is to challenge this as far as I can take it. I really believe that, especially the folks in my district and some of the other districts, really do not agree with this law at all and are not happy with the court decision that happened in 1995. And they're ready to stand up and say, we just don't believe it's the right way to go. And that is why I'm here today.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, so we are hearing this legislation today in order to trigger a Supreme Court challenge.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. To be truthful, I'm just trying to get it through this body, and that's as far as I'm looking right now. I know it's been a challenge through the years, and based on the support from my district, I'm willing to take that on.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, you understand that the Supreme Court has already ruled on this issue in Minnesota, and so you could pass this through this body, and it would be viewed as unconstitutional unless you're trying to trigger a Supreme Court challenge. Is that clear, Representative Tice?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. I understand that.
Thank you, Representative Tyson. We take these bills up every cycle, and they're challenging, I think. They're challenging for me, I will just say, because there are such strongly held beliefs. There are. If you think about human life and the lives of the people that we're talking about, and Representative Mack, I know we almost always agree on this point. We're talking about people, women, healthcare, and we talk about it so just without any emotion when we're here. I can't imagine what women who are listening to this must think. If they are in that position of having to face this choice, and we go through this routine over and over and over again, and it feels so disconnected from the real life experience of the women who and their partners who face this, and I just kind of getting to my breaking point on that. We should be working more to prevent the situation. We should. And we should be doing that together. Not this. If we all agree that we want to see a reduction in abortions, and that's where we've been heading, haven't we, Representative Liebling? Then we should be doing that. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask you one hard question. Would you be willing to hear the CHEER Act, which requires contraception coverage? Could we hear that here? And you don't have to answer right now. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but seriously, if our aim is to reduce abortion, we should be doing more to prevent it. I'll make my question a rhetorical one. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I just point out that Representative Tice has every opportunity to bring forward a bill, and we might have opinions on where that goes or what other actions that might trigger. I know that many folks in the legislature don't like the Citizens United verdict, for example, and we've seen several pieces of legislation moving on that at the state legislative level to move forward, and it's every right of the legislature and legislators to bring that forward to change the laws that they don't agree with and that represent the best interests of their constituents. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's funny that you referenced me, Representative Murphy, because I felt like I was having deja vu. I can't remember what term it was for me or what term it was for you, but it feels like a different life now, but that we were doing this very thing, and so I will probably say similar things to what I said then, that, there's a lot of issues, and it's not an easy conversation, but I guess just a couple of points just to challenge a few of the things I've heard said. I think to maybe suggest that just by simply Representative Tice bringing this bill forward, she's triggering a Supreme Court case, and while there might be evidence from the past to suggest that that might happen, we're all here with election certificates, not bound by anything the court has or has not said in the past, because we have the incredible honor and privilege of making laws that the court is responsible to uphold. And so I think that that's a valuable point for all of us to keep in mind as we approach our business here. And I also just want to say I think we have to be careful about what we make this about. and there's been a couple comments, Representative Scholl and Representative Lane, about this being about religion and imposing religious views. And I just want to challenge that, and you have your right to your opinion, absolutely, but I can just speak for myself that that's not what this is about, that it's not me believing that it's my religious views imposing on somebody else. To me, it's absolutely about protecting life. And I think that's where the crux of a lot of the debate can be. I won't put that on everybody else's views, but I do believe it's about protecting life, and I'm not interested in taking away people's choices. But what makes this issue so challenging is that this doesn't involve just one person's choice. At the point somebody becomes pregnant, it is now two lives in one body, and that's why it makes this decision so incredibly difficult to delineate, because now two lives are involved, and one of them has no say and has no choice in this matter. And that is, I'm not saying that that's an easy decision for any of us, but I do think that's what makes it so painstakingly difficult. And so just speaking for myself, I'm not interested in taking away choice. I am not trying to impose my religious views on other people, but it is absolutely about protecting life, and we can disagree on that, and I understand that, but I just think it's important to keep it in mind, because it seems like it's a hard thing sometimes for other people who disagree with me to understand that it's about protecting life, and it's not about anything else. And for anybody who's walked through this with a woman who's choosing abortion and has chosen abortion and has walked through that with them, they know it's not about demonizing women, and it's not about demonizing an agonizing choice, but it's about supporting people in very difficult situations, which is what we do in this committee. It's the name of the game in this committee, is people get dealt a really rough hand, either through poor choices or being a victim or whatever the case might be. And everything we do here that we're making decisions on is a product of some of those ills in our society and some of those bad things that happen. And so I just want to make the case that I respect Representative Tice for taking on a very difficult fight. I respect people who disagree with me on this issue, but let's just be careful about not making about something it's not about. It's not about religion. It is not about trying to hurt people's choices. And I realize I just speak for myself, but any other characterization is not fair. It is about protecting life, in my view, and that's what my vote represents.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mack, and I absolutely respect your opinion. And, you know, exactly all of the things that you said we can accomplish in a completely different way. We can protect life and not limit choices. And that is exactly what we're doing here today, is we're limiting choices. And you said you don't want to limit choices, but that is what we're doing. And I realize that your feeling is that, life, maybe there's somewhere down the road, and I'll go back to the men's issues. You know, I mean, sperm's alive. You need sperm to create that fetus, and it is life changing for whoever that may be. And there could be so many circumstances. And yes, I have had friends that have made the decision to have an abortion and to not have an abortion. Either way, those decisions were extremely difficult. And all I could say at the time was, as your friend, or as we are your friends, we're here to support you in any way that you need that, because that is the hardest decision I think I've ever seen people have to make in some circumstances. This is about limiting choice, and that is a choice to health care, that is a choice to life decisions. Not a single one of us in this room are perfect. And folks, this is just the wrong direction. Representative Halverson brought up a great point. The only reason that you would bring this bill forward is to, I mean, there's a statement here, and I absolutely respect that. We do that all the time. And if our goal is, if we ever did get this passed and it actually got signed into law, it's going to be a court challenge. Because these are the only bills, and there may be others, because I'm not a professional, but all the bills that I've seen come through here about that are anti-choice legislation have a severability clause that says, basically, we know it's going to be unconstitutional, but we're going to put it through anyway. So if the only lines 1.8, from starting at for the purposes of this section are the only thing left in the bill that are constitutional. At least we got a bill with a title and words to say we try. I get it. But in the end, people can say no. And we can do this in a different way. They don't have to have an abortion. We don't force people to have an abortion, nor should we take away their choice in this circumstance. I don't think that you should be forced into anything you want to do, and I don't think you should be limited from this ability either. And, I will say that probably over time my opinion has changed on this, and having a daughter has certainly changed that in a big, big way. She's 9 years old. And I don't know, I might not be on this planet 10 years from now to have a good discussion if something like this were to happen, because I know we'd sit around the dinner table and hopefully she would feel comfortable to come to me and say, Dad, this is what happened to me. And this is what I'm thinking. And we'll talk about the plus or minuses if we get into that situation, all the decisions and all the options that she could have to, which are include adoption, which include a million other things, whatever she decides she wants to do. But no matter what, I want her to know your dad is there for you to help make you, to support you in that decision. And I know it's going to be hard. And if the abortion is what she decides she needs to have for her, not for me or anybody else on this planet, but for her, then she should have that right. And we shouldn't be sitting here debating this particular issue. We should be doing things like the CHEER Act to help couples. And it's not just about women. It's about the men in those women's lives, too, that are helping create life, as you say. Work together. And I've said, probably in just a little bit over here, I don't want my testicles bothered any more in state law than I want your ovaries bothered in state law. I'll make those decisions, and so should you.
Representative Schoen, I think that members of this committee who probably hold a different view would consider people who are unborn some of our most vulnerable people. And as Representative Mack said, aside from religious points of view, we see one of our primary roles is to protect the people in our culture who are most vulnerable. We are a nation of laws. We are first a nation of rights. And we believe very strongly about that, those of us who hold this position. And Representative Tice, respect her for bringing this forward. And thank you. Last word, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will tell you why this bill is important to me. Because at 17, I wasn't in a position where I did make a choice. And while you as a father may think you know how you're going to react, you don't know for sure. My father never planned for it. We never talked about it. He was extremely supportive. But I will tell you that it wasn't at 17 necessarily my religious beliefs as much as it was that I couldn't stop a beating heart and call it health care. So I will tell you my son is 37 and he's married and has a 2-year-old son who's absolutely the most precious things to me. I'm here because I think a lot of women feel they don't have choices other than having an abortion because that's what they're told, because this is the only option for them. I'm bringing this forward again because, quite frankly, I think the discussion needs to continue to happen no matter what. And I certainly don't disagree at all about making it about contraception. I don't. But I do believe that stopping a heart is just not right. We have many laws that punish us for doing that. And that is my view. I could not do it, and it hurts me that anyone else makes that decision. So I'm just here to continue the conversation. I think that enough people are not happy with the way the law is. And if we don't say anything, people think we're fine with it. And so with that, I appreciate your support. I know not everybody's always going to agree on it, and we never will. But I'm willing to take it on and challenge it right now because it's that important to me. So with that, I hope I get your support.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we would like a roll call on this bill. But and Representative Tice, I appreciate your heartfelt statement that you've made. And I just do want to say to you, I'm glad that you were able to make your own choice. And the problem, I think, comes that and I think many of us probably believe that a fetus is life. I mean, I don't know how you can really deny that it's life. But that doesn't mean, that's not the end of the question for people. Because even in this bill, you said yourself, if a woman is raped or a victim of incest, then she could get an abortion. Well, that fetus is no less life than a fetus that was conceived under some other circumstances. So judgments are being made. And the real question, the real clincher, I think, for those of us who are on this side, is we don't believe that politicians should make that choice. And I think that Representative Schoen was talking about that very well. And you are a politician in this circumstance, and so am I. And that's really the issue here. Because if you have a daughter and she's pregnant, and you can say to your daughter, honey, I don't think it's within our values for you to have an abortion. And that's fine. You could have that conversation with her. When I see those billboards that say abortion stops a beating heart, I'm like, fine. Go out and tell people that. I have no problem with that at all. The place I have a problem is where we use the power of government to stop people. Not convince them, not talk to them, not offer them resources and make them able to carry their child to term. Not give them help, but stop them by the power of law, either by taking away the resources that they need, as in your bill, or literally stopping them by closing clinics and making it unavailable, or whatever the procedure is, or criminalizing it, as was done in the past. That is politicians telling women how to make those choices, and they are difficult choices. You've just demonstrated that yourself. And you were able to make that choice. And that is why this is so difficult and emotional for many of us, because we all here, I think, understand the complexity of these decisions. But when it comes down to making those really tough choices, we don't want government to tell people how to make them. We want people to be free to make them. And I think this is, I always thought that was a Republican value, that individuals should be able to make their own choices. And in this case, it appears not to be. And, you know, I get it, that this to you is a life and you want to stop everybody from destroying life. But it isn't an all or nothing. There are lots of situations where people have to make those choices themselves because the issues they have to balance are very subtle and personal issues. And I think that's what it comes down to. So we do need a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dean.
Yes.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Loeffler.
No.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hamilton. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Purcell.
No.
Representative Pearson.
Yes.
Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Zuwas.
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Pace.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we are going to move to House File 1632, which is Representative Backer's bill. If you could come forward and move your bill, Representative Backer. And I understand there is an amendment.
I will move that, Chair, and yes, there is a amendment.
All right, let's go ahead and move your bill, Representative Backer, House File 1632. We are moving that to... House File 1632 be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes.
All right, Representative Backer, and the bill is now before us, laid over for possible inclusion as a motion, and you have an amendment in the packet. Could you please describe your amendment and move that, Representative Backer?
What this amendment does is it clarifies the position, exactly what the position is, and just clarifies that we've came to this amendment after discussions with other state agencies.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Backer. Any questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Backer, to your bill.
Yes, I will be brief. What this bill does is, as we know, there is the American Disability Act from the federal government. And what this bill does is it allows additional funding. So organizations, for example, like when this Twin Stadium was built and the Viking Stadium, we're able to make sure that all Minnesotans, people with disabilities, can enjoy those facilities, and not just those facilities, but pretty much all the facilities. So with that said, I'm going to turn that over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I've been before you folks before. As you know, we're a small state agency that was established 41 years ago to advise government, state legislatures, state agencies, and the public about specific disability issues. And so today I'm just going to briefly tell you what this bill is about and why it's important. MSGET consists of 6.1 staff. We are small. We received just a little over $1.2 million dollars in per biennium in appropriation. We cross all aspects of the disability community, from building code accessibility, disability parking, employment, transportation, and we do this throughout across the state. We field an average of around 20,000 contacts a day, and that's like emails, trainings, calls, meetings, legislative contacts, and et cetera, in our office per year with that 6.1 staff. Most of the calls we receive are ADA-related issues, and therefore you could really say that much of our work is revolved around ADA and rights for people with disabilities. However, recently we have seen a drastic increase in the demand for accessible communication services as well. When we communicate with our constituents, it must be in a fully accessible format. We serve the general public, architects, design professionals, municipalities across Minnesota, as well as other state agencies in our work here at the council. The first position that you're looking at here will make agency communications accessible to our constituents and consult the public and private sector on the accessible communications to the disability community. The amendment that you just voted on really just narrows that down so that we're working on just the accessible communications piece in a consultative fashion. The second position we're looking at, we are requesting, will increase our capacity to do more accessibility work and begin succession planning for the current staff person who's been with us for 28 years, who leads the state projects on the accessibility issues for like the Twin Stadium, the Vikings, the Saints ballpark, and et cetera. You know, she's there to make sure that accessibility is enforced and inclusive basically to all Minnesotans. So it's for all of us basically. Over the last year, we have had to turn down many new projects. One project that we just can't get to, of course, is a big Mayo expansion, and we really should be at the table with that. And I just don't have the capacity to do that. So without this position, Minnesota will become perhaps a little less accessible and face possible non-compliance issues with the ADA. And as I said, this is especially important to all Minnesotans, especially our aging population. As people age, disability sometimes is incurred along the way. So now the $4,000 that's listed here covers the remainder of the 3% cost of living increase in fiscal year 2016. It's a one-time appropriation. The $30,000 that covers the upgrades in our computer system, and we need this in order to really upgrade our old system that's doing our tracking of our agency's work that we do, and really helps us, allows us to focus on our resources better too. Finally, as we look to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the ADA coming up here in July 26th this summer, we want to just make sure we can continue to do this good work as a technical resource to Minnesota's public and private sectors. This will really just increase our ability to just do the good work that we've been doing all these 41 years. So thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit more about our agency and the good work that we do.
Thanks, Ms. Wilshire. And could you tell me how many staff you have over there now?
6.1.
6.1. You guys, you do
a good day.
You do a lot of work in all our counties, and you do an excellent job. We do appreciate it. And also realize with ADA lawsuits and compatibility and changing codes, we do have a large cost that we pay when we don't take things into account up front. So we realize that you're an agency, actually, that does save our state a lot of money. So we appreciate the good work that you do.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Backer, Ms. Wilshire? Seeing none, Representative Backer removes his motion that House File 1632, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. 1632 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Ms. Wilshire. Representative Backer.
Thank you.
We're going to do one more bill today, and then we're going to be coming back tonight after Health and Human Services Policy Committee. The next bill that we have up will be House File 278, Representative Keel. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 278 be recommended to be re-referred on the Committee on Higher Education and Policy. I will go ahead and move that bill. The bill is before us. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Yes, members, you've already heard the research, a lot of the background of Alzheimer's and what we're talking about. What we need to talk about today basically is the funding, and unfortunately I don't have real detail on the funding because there was a little bit of a glitch and there's been some changes, but we're going to talk about what's in here. There is a grant for $5 million that appropriates for research and funds, and I believe we're going to hire it after this to talk about that some more. And then also grant programs that I believe are $500,000 a piece that deal with the state dementia grant program and also the regional and local projects to help educate people, whether it is nursing homes or families, to help take care of family members that have Alzheimer's. And then there's also funding for a public communications program to also advertise and to help people to connect to different resources so that they're able to get the help they need. With that, there's some new statistics, and we'd like to share those with you real briefly. We realize that we need to be done shortly here. But I have with me... I'm going to lose the name again, Deborah.
Same as yours.
Deborah, yeah, that I got. Anyway, and let her explain to you the new numbers.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Debbie Richmond, and I'm the Vice President for Education and Outreach for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota, North Dakota. And in the interest of time, you do have a copy of my written testimony. I would like to call your attention to a couple of items as a new facts and figures report was released yesterday that does show some significant increases in a couple of areas of interest that correlate directly with the bill. The first one I'd like to just call your attention to is, as we would have suspected, that the number of Americans living with the disease has now increased again to 5.3 million Americans. This is an increase over last year, and we would expect that number to continue to grow. A more significant change was that we have seen significant reductions in deaths related to heart disease, cancer, stroke, HIV, and in particular, the number of deaths reductions to HIV has now gone from 47% to 52% in terms of reduction, while Alzheimer's disease continues to rise from 68% increase between 2000 and 2010 to now 71%. So we are continuing to feel that sense of urgency to really find a way to effectively treat, delay the onset. Ultimately, it would be fabulous if we could find a cure, but we need an intervention for this disease fairly soon. Thank you.
Is there any other testifiers in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill?
I don't believe so today.
Seeing none, I just had a question for Representative Keel.
Yes.
Representative Keel, I know this is taking a little bit of a different turn in the Senate as we're looking at research on disease-specific research as things move through. Could you talk a little bit about some of the changes that have taken place and kind of how we're lining up currently with your bill?
You know, we have heard it in Health and Human Services and have talked about the effects of Alzheimer's and the costs. I know that in the Senate they have talked about the research portion as directed to higher ed, and have been talking about the research. And I realize that typically we don't fund a specific health problem situation. However, this is very serious and something that we need to really approach with vengeance. We need to really, really look at it, come after it. It is very costly to our system, but more importantly, I think it's really costly to our families and the challenges that we deal with as family either get dementia or Alzheimer's. The challenges that it prevents or poses. So, you know, that is my understanding now, is that Health and Human it is going through higher ed through the Senate, and there are some different finance concerns also, Mr. Chair. I don't think I explained, and I thought the department might be here, but they did. The Minnesota Department of Aging did contact me and tell me that it would probably cost. There's a 1% clause in this bill, and we're still talking about what that might cost. But it sounds more like it 1% only equals $12,000. They're telling me that they would need to hire somebody to manage this, so then it would be closer to $44,000 rather than the $12,000 that is in the bill at this time. So,
thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, I'm looking at the appropriations part of this, and if you said this and I missed it, I apologize, but Office of Higher Education, that the money's going to go through higher education?
In the Senate, it is. This wasn't the intent of this bill when it started out. So we have not taken it through higher ed yet. But in the Senate, that's where they went with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just looking at line 7.10 and the language that's there, and that's my question. So,
Representative Keel.
Yes, and I understand that that's why it is, you know, that is that conversation, that it is going to higher education. So, and I'm not sure the conversation, I haven't had a chance to talk to the senator yet about where they ended up. So,
that's kind of the crux of the argument is how to deal with disease-specific research and whether those are through grants or direct appropriations, and I think that that's the discussion that they're currently having in the Senate, as I understand it, within the higher ed division, Representative Purcell. So I'd expect a similar discussion in our higher ed. I don't know if you serve on that committee or not.
Mr. Chair, I want to make clear I support the bill. I just had that question. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Appreciate that. Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we see all over our Health and Human Services budget that sometimes you have to invest money to save money. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, the advocates for this bill have done a really good job of educating us about this problem, and I really do appreciate that. And I hope that we can do something for that. You know, I certainly think that the grants for services and, you know, that kind of falls in line with the kinds of things that we do in Minnesota, it's really critical that we move forward with helping families and, you know, really trying to be innovative about how we deliver services. And, you know, I really do understand your argument that this is just a tsunami. And we've got the silver tsunami, and then I guess we've got the purple part of the silver tsunami, right? And, you know, I think that you've all done a wonderful job. I do still, you know, have my – I just want to raise my hand to sort of explain a little bit more about my concern about the disease-specific thing and why that – you know, I hope maybe in Minnesota, maybe we need to think about this for the future of having sort of an institute of health, the Minnesota Institute of Health. If we decide to go the way of that, there are certain disease-specific research that we think as a state would be good for us to fund, so that we put together a panel of, you know, a way to make these decisions and take it a little bit out of the political arena. Because if it were only about how important it's going to be to our economy and so on, but we know that when we think about how to fund research, there's so much more going on than that, because, you know, if you said to me, that, you know, here are two research projects, which one do you want to fund? Well, there's just so much that we here in the legislature can't really understand or don't have the time to understand about, you know, what is really promising, which dollars are really well invested and which might not be, how close somebody might be to making a breakthrough. And if only it were so easy to say, golly, if we gave you $5 million, we'll have a cure, I think we would all just say, how fast can we do it? You know, and I wish it were that, and I hope it will be that. You know, but I certainly hope that that Representative Dean and his bill is going to be able to put some funding toward this. I would certainly like to see that. I would certainly be in support of that. And I think, Representative Keel, you've done a really great job bringing this forward and pushing it and bringing it to everybody's attention. And, you know, I know it's very personal to you, too. And I know a lot of members feel the same way about it. And if it doesn't hit our family today, it probably will soon. Mm-hmm. So I know that we all have a big stake in this, and just wanted to speak up and tell you that I, you know, really appreciate your work here. So thank you.
Well, Representative Keel, I think one of the things that we need to really think about and look at is the cost. And everybody's talking about our budget target today. And how can you be spending $1.1 billion less and still spend $400 million more in Health and Human Services? Where are all those dollars going, you know, and that's what Representative Knobloch wants to know, and lots of other people. And I think, you know, this sheet really is an important thing to think about. If you got this in your packet, just pull this one sheet out. If you don't take anything else with you, members, it's the Alzheimer's Disease Treatments and Savings for Medicare. If you just look at the costs of where we are, I had remember the number sticking in my head is $217 billion nationally for health care for Alzheimer's in the United States. Minnesota's population is 1/50th of the country. So if you divide every national number by 50, you kind of get a good feel, plus or minus, from where we are, that $217 billion nationally. And if you look at where our state budget is going and what's growing the fastest and what is displacing other dollars, it's Medicaid. And that's what this is. This is people taking care of other people. It's not fancy machines. It's not diagnostic equipment. It's people taking care of other people, which is the most expensive thing that we have in Health and Human Services. It's the most expensive thing that Joe's people in the aging committee are dealing with. It's people taking care of people, and that's what we have in Minnesota. We're a big-hearted state. We take care of each other, and it's very expensive. So when we look at that cost spike for Alzheimer's, how can we not address it if we are really serious about getting control over our budgets and Health and Human Services and Medicaid? So I really applaud the efforts, and I know it's an uphill climb. I know the disease-specific is an extremely difficult, challenging thing to push forward, but I would encourage you to keep finding a way at every single stop along the way to keep doing what you're doing. So with that last word, Representative Keel.
Well, first of all, members, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this again and the acknowledgement that this is a serious issue. And more importantly, we need to think about the fact that this is people. We are taking care of our citizens. And whether we take care of them in the beginning of life or the end of life, it is really important to value their life. There are many, I won't share my stories now, but there are many, many things that happen at the end of life that are very important, even when we're confused and don't know who our family is or what's happening around us. There's just some real value there, and that's what's important about doing the research and helping to help families to take care of their family members, and for our institutions to be able to help them also to be successful in taking care of those who have lost their memory or have difficulty with life in general. So with that, I would thank you very much and hope you support the bill.
Thank you. The motion before us is that House File 278 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Policy, and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 278 is re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Policy, and Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel. Members, we are going to recess, and we will be coming back 15 minutes after the health reform policy concludes in the basement this evening. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe this would be a good moment since we have 2 minutes. I just wanted to ask you if you have a sense of the timing of when your bill might be, when you might be bringing out your omnibus bill. Maybe you know your deadline for that now. And if you do, whether you could share that with the committee.
Representative Liebling, we are working on that, and we will update the committee when we have firmer dates.
Okay. Thank you.
What, Representative Purcell.
What time does that other committee meet? Have an idea about what's going on here.
Health reform is going to meet downstairs in the basement this evening. Did Representative Mack escape yet? 6:15 downstairs. That reform committee will start, and I'm sure they would welcome your participation if you'd like to show up early and check it out. Yeah, that's right. We need all the help we can get. Thank you, Representative Purcell. We are in recess until this evening. All right, we are going to start up again. Members, please grab your spots. Representative Keel has House File 606 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I will go ahead and move House File 606. Is before us, Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good evening. House File 606 is a bill requesting that we require abortion facilities to be licensed and inspected on a yearly basis for up to 2 times a year in the same way an outpatient surgical center are regulated. This would affect basically 5 abortion facilities in Minnesota. When a woman is looking for an abortion, she's expecting to visit a place where she is safe and can count on those who are attending her that this, in case, is in fact the situation. Here in Minnesota, we do not have any reason to question the abortion facilities and do, in fact, keep sterile equipment and follow medical practices expected in an outpatient surgical center. This bill works toward the same consideration for abortion facilities. So there is no question, or that we'll find out later, that women who have suffered consequences from a procedure that reportedly is 99% safe, but wasn't at that time. Because this is a health and safety finance committee, we should concentrate on the financial request of this bill. The bill request is for a fee of $3,712 for a license, which is the same as an outpatient surgical center. And there are other cost assumptions in the finances, which I'm assuming you all have received for other inspections and possible violations. And with that, Mr. Chair.
All right, I see that there are testifiers. We have Andrea Rao from MCACL. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Rao with MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. I'm their legislative director, and I will be happy to answer any questions as they come about. But
thank
it's
you.
Late.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. We also have Andrea Ledger from NARAL. If you'd like to come forward, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Ledger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. But our concern with this bill is that abortion is an extremely safe procedure. The state of Minnesota annually publishes a report on induced abortions in Minnesota. The most recent year that data is available, 2013, shows a complication rate for abortion of 0.006%, which is an extremely small rate of complication, making abortion safer than appendectomies. And that complication rate is nearly halved from the previous rate of that was reported in 2011. Research also confirms that the risk of abortion is lower than that from a shot of penicillin. Unnecessary and burdensome regulations can actually make abortion less safe for patients. A 2011 analysis from the New England Journal of Medicine, a healthcare economist studied state laws regulating abortion clinics and concluded that restrictions aimed at shutting down abortion providers or supply-side policies had little effect on the demand for abortion. Instead, they either forced women to travel further to obtain health care or denied those with the fewest resources the ability to access wanted services. That study predicted that, quote, making access to abortion unnecessarily costly through these restrictions will probably result in clandestine abortions and unintended childbearing among families with the least resources and the fewest options. The further concern to us is the bill's requirement that the Department of Health inspects clinics without notice, a provision that singles out providers of abortion. According to the Minnesota rules, other clinics that are licensed as outpatient surgical centers are subject to inspection, but with notice. We don't oppose reasonable provider inspections. However, there must be adequate safeguards to protect patient safety so that patients feel like their health care rights and their health care privacy aren't being intruded on. I'd urge you to vote no on this bill because it singles out abortion providers and creates rigid, unreasonable standards that don't protect patient safety. Thank you.
All right. I do see. Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I'll close the testimonial portion of the bill and go to the Amendment A4. Who would like to offer that? That's the DFL amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A4 amendment, I would move the A4 amendment and ask for a roll call. What it does is reflects the fact that this bill, as it is before us, is expected to require the facilities affected by this bill to make major, major investments in remodeling their facility in a way that isn't expected and has not been expected in the past. And in the policy committee, we heard testimony about what this would involve and some potential costs. We have in our packet a letter from Laura Casey, who's the executive director of the Women's Health Center up in Duluth, about the extensive remodeling that would need to be done just in that one facility. for exam, and some of it, quite honestly, I don't think has a lot to do with patient safety. They currently have one gender-neutral restroom, and to accommodate the requirements of an ambulatory care center as defined in this bill, they would have to have separate male and female restrooms right off the waiting area. A gender-neutral one would not suffice. They'd have to add another janitor's closet. I'm not sure what that's about. Employee locker room, enlarge hallways, and make other expensive physical accommodations. And if we're going to put a mandate on any kind of health provider, I don't care what the services are, I think we need to recognize that we're imposing some major costs, and in order for their patients to be able to access this service. And so this appropriates $3.2 million for grants to these facilities so that they can meet the legislative intent as described by the author of this bill to provide for safety of the patients. And this will make sure that that safety is achieved quickly and with a reasonable assurance that they can meet the new standards imposed by this bill.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Discussion to the A4 amendment?
Here.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, this amendment really calls out whether this bill is really about health and safety, as has been said, or whether it's really just about stopping abortions. If this is really about health and safety, then there shouldn't be any problem allocating the money to make sure that this can happen. But I strongly suspect, because it's been done in other places, and it's and because, you know, we've got MCCL at the table, that this is really about stopping abortions, making abortions harder for women to be able to have and have them be safe. And I think that if that's the case, I think that we are, you who vote for this bill, will be putting women's safety at greater risk. And I think it's really too bad that in some ways, well, let me take that back. It's good that the bad old days are behind us, of where women mostly got illegal abortions. But what's really too bad is that few people really have any experience of that anymore or remember what that was like. And, you know, I'm old enough to have heard stories from women and have known women who had abortions in the bad old days. And the risk to health and safety was great. And a lot of women did die, and they were so desperate that they would go to any lengths to get an abortion, and safe and legal abortion did not exist for them or was very hard to come by. I really hope that we're not going to go back to those days under the guise of improving women's health. So if you're really about improving women's health and you really think that these clinics really need to be inspected and really need to have different bathrooms and wider hallways, then you should be willing to allocate the funding so that they can do it and remain open for the women who need their services. So I would urge members to vote for this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I don't really know if there's a necessity for this kind of fee or appropriated dollar amount, because in the Minnesota State statutes, 144.56, it states in there that there's a waiver. Physical plant deficiencies must be may be waived by the Commissioner of Health for recognizing an existing center which is functioning prior. And then when such deficiencies do not constitute an unacceptable compromise in the patient treatment and the safety and correction would involve major remodeling and cause for unusual hardship, there would be this waiver that would be provided. So, and if there's a danger for women now, then that needs to be corrected. But there would be a waiver. There's a possibility of a waiver. So,
thank you. Further discussion, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the fact that there is a waiver. There's no guarantee that that would be waived. Because the bill requires a certain standard, and I suspect that it can be waived for one minor change or one or two maybe minor changes, but for the substantial changes that would be required of our currently operating healthcare clinics that provide this service, it is highly doubtful, given the language of your bill, that they would be able to waive basically the requirements of the bill. And so while I think it's appropriate that we have a waiver process, it's really not intended to totally negate the requirements in state law. And so I do believe that we do need to do this. And I think it's also important to note that while I don't represent Greater Minnesota, we did hear testimony in the policy committee that this would probably result, without this funding, in unequal access just geographically, because the Duluth Clinic does not believe that there's any way they could raise the kind of money that would be required to do this kind of physical work, remodeling work, and still be able to provide services, and that we may end up in a situation in which the only provision of this legal service, medical service, is available in the Twin Cities. And so we're once again reducing the opportunities available to people in Greater Minnesota. And I think it's fair when we put a mandate in law that we ought to step up with the resources to make that mandate fulfillable by our nonprofit health centers.
All right. There's a roll call been requested?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like
to. All right, roll call haven't been requested. There will be a roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
Nope.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer. Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Helverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton. Representative Lane.
Yes.
Representative Lomer.
No.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
Aye.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the amendment is not adopted. There is another amendment in the packet. Who would like to offer the next amendment, A5?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Helverson offers the A5 amendment. Representative Helverson, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point about safety of procedures for women, I am offering the A5 amendment because, as we have heard in testimony, risks for abortion procedures are incredibly low. In fact, when you do a little research, you find out that they're significantly lower than having a dental procedure. And I don't see anything in this bill that seeks to license any other type of clinic other than abortion procedures. And so while the suggestion has been made that this is about women's health, I can't help but feel that there is a need or a desire to single out a specific women's health care procedure that's legal and that's done at specific clinics. It's also one of the safest medical procedures in the United States. And with such a clear track record of safety, it's very clear that the medical community has gotten this right. We have gone from women dying from back alley abortions to women being safe. We've gone from women not having access to reproductive health care services and suffering greatly for it with their lives and with their health, to being able to access safe and legal
health care from the entire spectrum. And so the fact that we're singling out this one procedure is of great concern to me. And so the A5 amendment actually requires that we license all healthcare clinics in Minnesota, and the amendment appropriates money so that the Minnesota Department of Health can carry out their work. And I'd like a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call for the discussion on the A5 amendment. Seeing no further discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, with regard to this particular amendment, I'd like to ask the author a question. Is it your intent, Representative, to single out these particular clinics, or is it your intent to create a safer healthcare environment for all Minnesotans?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, my intent is to make this safe for women who expect to be treated in that manner when they are looking for an abortion. As it stands now, abortion facilities are treated in a different manner than other outpatient surgical centers because they are not licensed like those facilities are.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
And to the author, have you been approached by the Minnesota Department of Health with concerns over the operation and safety of clinics that perform abortion procedures in Minnesota?
No.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
And have you heard from physicians in Minnesota that they are concerned about the safety and efficacy of abortion procedures in Minnesota?
No.
Representative Keel.
And Mr. Chair, I think that there might be something in our packet from the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you. That is, I think, very clearly states why singling out one particular clinic over another for licensing standards is certainly dangerous precedent, and that we are putting a dangerous precedent in terms of coming between women and their physicians. It's very clear from the safety record of our physician providers and from our clinics that there is not a safety risk to women that's being posed. The safety risk actually happened before services were available to people, and so I strongly encourage us to adopt the A5 amendment and not single out women's health care if we are concerned about the health and safety of patients.
All right, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to echo that last comment. And I think, you know, we need to respect the judgment of the physicians who care for people and their knowledge about what patient safety is and isn't. And I would just note the second to the last sentence on this memo, our letter advising us from the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA is not convinced that patient safety is advanced in any meaningful way as a result of the licensing requirements established in this legislation. And so I think we're hearing from the experts who are trained in delivering health care that we have a false premise put before us that putting these additional requirements on will in any way improve patient safety in the eyes of the doctors who we all rely on for safe and effective medical care, no matter what the medical treatment is that we're getting.
For the discussion. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel, for bringing this bill forward. I would say there's one person or human being that the environment is unsafe for in the clinic, and that's the unborn child, okay? Since we know that's a human being. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
Nope.
Representative McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer. Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Lane.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
There being seven ayes and nine nays, the Amendment A5 is not adopted. All right. Member questions to the bill. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is for the department, if there's someone here from the department, but I'm looking at the fiscal note here of $20,000, and looks like the department made an assumption that the Office of Administrative Hearings would be needed each biennium. So with only five facilities, that seems like a lot to me. So I'm just wondering what you're basing your assumptions on. Are you anticipating finding problems?
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman, I'm Budget Director with the Health Department. We've when this bill's come before the legislature in the past, we've made the same assumption. We're not necessarily assuming that this these types of facilities are going to be treated any differently than other types. However, we do occasionally get hearings that go before the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we previous history with newly licensed types of facilities, often there are, tend to be more as we sort of settle in on what the licensing rules are, there tends to be more appeals. We don't necessarily always get these costs funded in the fiscal note. I mean, we put them in the fiscal note because if there is an appeal, it has to come out of this budget. And so we put it in there based on our experience with other types of newly licensed facilities.
Thank you. And Mr. Greenman, could you just talk about, let's say, an ambulatory surgical center, for example, for an orthopedic surgeon? You're going to go and get your knee scoped. The one closest to my house is High Point Surgical Center right off of Highway 94. What is the licensing and requirements for those facilities?
Mr. Chair, you're talking about an outpatient surgical center? I'm afraid I don't know exactly what the I do the numbers. I'm not sure what the rules are regarding the surgical center.
Mr. Pollack, please introduce yourself for the committee and answer the questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, it all began many years ago. Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner of Health Department. I'm going to offer more expert than me, if you can believe there is, you know, that's possible.
It's always good to see you, Mr. Pollack. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and for the committee, and if you can answer that question, great. If not, if we could get some info back, that'd be great, too.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Darcy Miner. I'm the Director of the Health Regulation Division at the Health Department, and I'm sorry, would you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, sure. It's just questions about kind of comparisons with a similar or other outpatient surgical facilities. For example, if you're going to get your knee scoped, rather than going to a hospital, a lot of people like to go to an outpatient ambulatory surgical center. The one closest to my house is High Point Surgical Center. Where they would scope your knee and you're kind of in and out, and they're typically not connected to a hospital, but they do provide outpatient surgical procedures. And I'm just wondering what kind of licensure and what kind of building codes that they have to follow.
Mr. Chairman and members, unfortunately, the nurse who was our expert is not here this evening, but in general, I can tell you that the physical plant requirements for an outpatient surgical center include such things as having a separate patient prep area, a surgery area, and a post-recovery area, And within a surgical suite, there would be an operating room, a separate clean workroom for collecting materials to be used during surgery, a soiled workroom for materials from the surgery, a separate space for cleaning equipment, a janitor's closet, and separate male-female gowning areas. And those are just the summary of what staff had provided to me.
All right, thank you. And if you maybe could just follow up with the committee, or I can ask for that. I think we had a couple other questions about that, maybe in policy, so just maybe want to follow up with that. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the testifier, what Chair Dean, you said that maybe do some scope work in there. What else they do in those outpatient surgical clinics? I mean, are they cutting people open, or what are they doing? Sorry, I'm an old medic, you know, I'm talking like that, so. Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Representative, the definition in Minnesota statutes for the outpatient surgical center means a freestanding facility organized for the specific purpose of providing elective outpatient surgery for pre-examined, pre-diagnosed, low-risk patients. It goes on to say that it talks about the admissions. They're limited to procedures that utilize general anesthesia, do not require overnight care, so there's a limit of, I think, 23 hours to be in there. An outpatient surgical center is not organized to provide regular emergency medical services, does not include physicians or dentist's office or clinic for the practice of medicine. Is that sufficient?
Representative Purcell.
And my only curiosity is, what are they doing in there? Do you have any idea? I mean, they aren't doing appendectomies, but what kind are they, cutting out cysts? Or do you have an idea? Or if you don't, you don't.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I do know that among the things that they do are various hip surgeries, knee replacements, knee surgeries. I don't know what else is done there, and I can get that information.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Purcell.
Did you say knee replacements?
I'm not sure that it's knee replacements. It's knee surgeries.
Knee surgeries.
For certain.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you. They're doing some serious stuff anyway, so thank you.
Representative Purcell, I can offer you a tour of the High Point Surgical Center and St. Croix Orthopedics. If you ever have trouble getting up and down the stairs really quick, I'm sure you don't have any trouble now, but if you ever do, we can go out there and get you into shape and moving quick. So
you may be taking up on that more soon than you think.
Well, we're all getting there, right? Representative Liebling.
I raised my hand.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is either for the author of the bill or for Ms. Miner. I understand, regardless of which clinic we're talking about, an outpatient surgical clinic or a clinic where they're providing abortion, that the providers are licensed. Is that your understanding as well, that the physicians and the nurses are licensed professionals?
Representative Keel.
That is my understanding, that they are licensed.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, so if they are licensed providers and there was an incident of harm that occurred in the performance of a procedure, would that provider then be liable?
Representative Keel.
I would assume so, you know, but I would imagine the investigation would go to what exactly happened, whether it was a problem with a physician or if there was something done within the facility itself in the surgery center.
And Mr. Chair, and you know, I only ask the question because while I understand, you know, that there is a regulatory scheme for our hospitals, and in descending order, outpatient surgical centers, outpatient clinics, providers who are humans who are actually intervening on behalf of a patient, they're the ones that are licensed. They're the ones that are liable. They're the ones responsible and actually doing the work. And it seems to me that that is the license that is the safeguard for the patients who are being cared for in all of these facilities. A facility is a place, right? It is a place, but the actual care that's being provided is it's an interaction between people, a doctor, a nurse, a patient. And that license is, I think, the one that's important in this discussion, right? That the professional doing the procedure, if something happens, that they are the ones that are likely responsible. And that, I think, is the safeguard for women in the care of these providers, because they need to be, of course, competent, licensed, trained, and vigilant. And if they're not, they're responsible for that. And I think, actually, that the licensure scheme that's in place right now is satisfying those needs and protecting women. So I think that I understand what you're bringing forward here, but I think that the licensure scheme that we have in place in Minnesota for providers is the one that assures the safe provision of care.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the department, I'm curious. We are talking about abortions in terms of surgery, and I believe that there are numerous medical options to terminate a pregnancy that aren't actually considered surgery. I know that there are medicine-induced, and I'm wondering, from a licensing standpoint, how many abortions in Minnesota actually are considered surgery versus a medical procedure? And perhaps we can, I just asked a tough question, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm thinking about it in terms of a tooth extraction. You know, that gets done in a clinic setting, in a non-licensed, you know, a facility that's not a licensed ambulatory surgical setting, but it's done under the license of a dentist. But there are also dental procedures that rise to the level of surgery, so.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Halverson. The report that is actually on the Health Department, this is the 2013 numbers, but 2,660 were non-surgical. 6,259 were surgical. Oh, excuse me. Never mind. I can do quick math. It's a little over 7,000 that are surgical.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, and how many are non-surgical?
2,660.
Mr. Chair? And when you consider, in terms of the health department statistics, is that strictly medicine-induced abortions, or is it other procedures as well that are considered surgery?
Representative Keel.
Do you want the rundown? 6,259 are suction. I can't pronounce that word.
Curettage.
950 are DNEs, dilation and evacuation. 6 are intrauterine installation. 11 are DNCs, sharp curettage. 14 are induction of labor. 2 are intact dilations and extractions. And 1 says it's another method. So.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, so looking at those numbers, and I think it's important that we're very clear in terms of what's considered surgery and what is considered non-surgery, and it's I think clear from the department's website that the majority of them are actually non-surgical, and so and of course we could have a physician confirm that, but so licensing these clinics like a surgery center again seems unnecessary when most of the procedures are non-surgical. And then the ones that are surgical are clearly not requiring, for the most part, you know, we're not seeing intensive
follow-up needed from these procedures. On the other hand, if you look at the world and places where abortion is not safe and legal, and even in our own United States, we're seeing an uptick actually in illegal abortion. 68,000 women die annually every year in this world from illegal and unsafe abortion, and they suffer sepsis and they lose their internal organs, and it's a horrifying situation. And now we're seeing an uptick in the United States because of lack of access. I think the testimony of the fact that we're going to make things unsafer for women is very compelling when you consider that it doesn't, the evidence is there that closing down access does not reduce women's need for these services, and that they're performing them themselves. In fact, there is a medical journal, I think the Journal of Western Medicine, in 2009 found it necessary to write a journal article on how to treat sepsis and emergency room situations from illegal, unsafe abortions, because emergency room physicians are starting to see them more than we'd seen them in the past, and we'd seen them prior to 1972. And the fact that we are having to retrain our physicians to save women from unsafe abortion because we are cutting off access to poor women. We're cutting off access for rural women. We're, the majority of counties in the country do not have a provider to go to. And yet women are not, they haven't stopped seeking out these services. And so if we are really serious about reducing the need for abortion service in this state, in this country, I would be highly supportive of not taking this route, of not taking a route that does not make women safer, of not taking a route that puts women at risk, that makes women unable to access services early in their pregnancy, puts off the procedure until later. They're still accessing the services. We're putting them at greater risk. Let's do what the science says actually works and what has actually proven to reduce abortions in this state. And we have seen a decline of legal abortion in this state because of things like comprehensive sex education, because of things like access for all women to contraceptive services, regardless of income, regardless of who their insurer is. Those are the things that are going to make women safer. Those are the things that are going to protect women's health. And those are the things that are going to reduce the need for abortion services in this state. So I share that goal. I believe that that's your goal, Representative Keel, and I'd be happy to work with you on scientifically proven ways to reduce abortion services in this state.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on Representative Purcell's question. I looked up High Point Surgical Center on my iPhone, and they do things like gallbladder operations, hernia, eye surgery, ACL reconstruction, spine surgery, removing a disc, carpal tunnel, rotator cuff surgery, shoulder surgery, joint replacement, and total knee replacement. Much more invasive.
Representative Purcell, if our knees are really bad, we're still in good shape over at High Point. I can see that. Thank you, Representative Lane. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Any further questions, Representative Liebling?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on the bill.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
And then I just wanted to comment that I think Representative Grunhagen kind of said it. You know, this isn't about women's health. This isn't about women's safety. This is really about just another way to try to stop abortions. And I think that when we're honest about what the discussion is and what the concerns are, we can have a good debate. It's really hard to do that when people are putting forward something. And not to you, Representative Keel, I respect you a great deal, but this bill is not, MCCL brings this bill, and this bill's or similar things have been done all over the country, and the point of them is to try to stop women's access to abortion, to make clinics close, and that's worked well in a lot of states where women no longer can get to an abortion center and get an abortion legally anymore with any kind of reasonable access, and that is what this is about. And so members should, if you care about women's safety, if you really care about women's safety, then you should be voting no on the bill.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, is this, it looks like when I read the bill, you create a new crime. Is that correct?
Representative Keel.
You'd have to tell me what you're referring to.
Is there a misdemeanor crime that you're creating in this bill?
No, I don't believe so.
Looks like on 1.18, obtaining a license is a misdemeanor. Or on 1.18, it says, so if we start 1.17, mm-hmm. The establishment or operation of a facility described in this section without obtaining a license is a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of not more than $300. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And where is this bill going next?
Ways and Means, I believe. No. Ways and Means?
Yes.
Has this bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, has this bill been to public safety or civil law? Public safety judiciary?
Mr. Chair, no. No, it is not.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this bill is creating a new crime, and which is, I mean, is under the purview of public safety judiciary, and it appears there, I mean, likely that it should also go to civil law as well, too.
Excuse me, I believe we were at civil law earlier.
You were. And so, well, that's good. But we didn't make it to public safety judiciary. I didn't see civil law on it either, but you know, one way or the other. I mean, I'd make a motion. This bill, actually, just to make it clear before this goes to the Ways and Means and to the floor, it needs to go to public safety judiciary if we're creating a crime. And then we'd also, as far as it goes with that, if we're creating another criminal section of law, I mean, there's a cost to public safety judiciary budget when it's, as it relates to court and any fines or court costs or penalties as well, too, Mr. Chair. So that's my statement on this particular bill, is just make a motion that it needs to actually go to public safety judiciary.
All right. The current motion on the table is that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Schoen moves that the bill be referred to the Committee on
Public Safety Judiciary. And I'd ask for roll call. I mean,
roll call hasn't been requested. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dean.
No.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer. Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Lane.
Yes.
Representative Lomer.
No.
Representative Mack. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we'll try this from one more angle. It did not get to civil law.
No.
And there's definitely some privacy issues related to this. Is it this is one of those that allows MDH to do some surprise unscheduled inspections. And quite frankly, I mean, I don't know any bill that has, if some, maybe staff can answer this. Do we have any bills that you know of, Mr. Berg or Ms. Olson, that have come through this committee that have created a crime that didn't go to the committee that deals with crime, Public Safety Judiciary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I can't say that for sure.
I don't know of any bills off the top of my head that created a crime that did not go to public safety and judiciary.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and so, I mean, this has got civil law repercussions as well, and I hope that the folks, I mean, we all have our opinions. We know where we're going to be. You're going to win this one. You're in the majority. And but the reality is we do need, if this actually becomes law, we do need to deal with the issues in the committees and the jurisdiction that they belong in. And we have privacy, we have crime, and we're bypassing that. And I mean, ways and means, obviously, we all know that's the most powerful committee we have. You're outside of rules, I suppose. Maybe rules, they can do anything they want to do because they make up the rules. And the best part about rules, they can change the rules. But, so then my next motion is, Mr. Chair, noting that Minnesota Department of Health can come in and do a surprise inspection anytime they want to, see the records of whoever. I mean, we don't even know exactly what your repercussions are to patient confidentiality on those surprise inspections. And I would ask that my motion is that we at least send this to civil law and maybe get it started down the right road, because it still needs to go to public safety. I still contend that. And so that's my motion, and I ask for a roll call on the motion to send this to civil law.
The motion currently before us is to re-refer House File 606 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Schoen moves that the bill go to the Committee on Civil Law. Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
No.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer. Representative Franson.
Amendment bill, I can't keep up.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton. Representative Lane.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yep.
Representative Purcell.
Aye.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill did go through government operations. That's where it came from, before going to Health and Human Services reform. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before we wrap up this, but I just want to say I'm really disappointed in these votes to not re-refer this bill, because, members, I think Representative Schoen has it exactly right. No matter what the subject matter is, the rules are the rules. And I think it's a bit more arguable whether it needs to go to civil law, but certainly it needs to go to public safety. It does create a crime that's as clear as can be in the bill. And to not send a bill to the committees of jurisdiction, you can't make up the rules. Even when you're in the majority, you just can't make them up. And that is really disappointing. And that, if you don't want to follow the rules, just remember that this place flips, majority control flips a lot. And some of you have been in the minority, now you're in the majority. I've been in the minority 3 times, majority 3 times. The rules are the rules, and certainly this one about sending bills to committees that they really do pertain to is a pretty basic one. So I think that's really disappointing to see that kind of a vote over a bill that I think it's more about the content of the bill than the procedure, and that really shouldn't happen.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, as we wrap up this, members, you know, this really is about making sure that women are protected, that they can expect to go into a facility, an abortion facility, and trust that everything is for their care. Their relationship with their physician is also important, and there's been suggestion that maybe we really don't care about women, but then in fact, even in my own personal area, I have two pregnancy centers. No, they're not abortion facilities, but they do much more than that. They care for a young lady or a woman who is in a time of stress, also help families, help them to be educated, to provide services for them and their child. Should they choose to keep the child, help them connect to abortion or adoptions if they would like to. Their success rates are growing by leaps and bounds. And what I see and hear from young women, women of all ages that I've heard from, they feel much more cared for and success in these supportive systems rather than just walking into a clinic and taking care of a supposed problem and walking away. With regard to this risk of sepsis, the risk of sepsis is everywhere. That is in a medical facility, that happens very easily. I've actually had experienced that with an aunt that's in a nursing home, and they couldn't even find it right away because it wasn't even much of a skin break at all. Actually, it was a pinprick. And sepsis is deadly and fast. It's not to be messed around with and can kill you in a short while. A young woman could go home not even knowing that they had an infection. But we don't know all of those statistics either. At any rate, this really is about making sure that we have a safe facility for women and that we can expect that they will be safe for them when they seek to get advice and then consequently an abortion if need be. And with that, members, I would hope you'd support this, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Representative Schoen, you have another comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So in the last couple of years, when we were in the majority, Representative Paymar was the chair of public safety, and Representative Cornish, or Chair Cornish, right now of public safety judiciary, you know, worked together pretty well on issues in that committee's jurisdiction. And, I mean, we know that no matter, even when we were in the majority, the House was not, it was an anti-choice body. So you're going to win no matter what. But the reality is, this bill is going to Ways and Means and then onto the floor without making the appropriate stops. And I had a bill with the Department of Human Rights, and I got dressed down by Chair Paymar of my own party because it didn't get into public safety to talk. Now, Chair Cornish was kind enough to go, you know what, it really doesn't cost but a nickel, and it really doesn't change a ton of things, but the reality is it should have been in the committee. This creates a whole new crime, and you know what, you could send it to public safety, and you're still going to get your way, Representative Keel. Send it off to civil law, you're still going to get your bill, and it's going to keep going on down the line. But it follows the procedures that we have in this body. And I'm disappointed that that's not happening. And we could get into all the other issues of why this is right or wrong on choice or otherwise, or how it compares to other medical facilities and, you know, what we're doing here versus what we're not doing over here. It doesn't matter. You know, the vote's going to be the same in the end. But, you know, we really got to get back to, whether it's in committee or on the House floor, following the procedures that are set in place and the rules that we choose as a body, and get them into the committees of jurisdiction that they belong in. Like it or not, sometimes it slows us down from what our personal agenda is, But that is the way it works, and you know, it's too bad that we're not doing that here. We can do better than that, and I hope that we do better than that as we move forward.
Representative Schoen, I appreciate that. You did make the case. You did ask for a vote, as is your right, and ask for a roll call. That did not pass. You can also make the motion on the floor to re-refer, and I certainly can help you do that if you're with the front desk. If you're not familiar with how to do that, I'd be happy to help you do that as well. And as we move forward, also in committee, in the Ways and Means Committee as well. Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean.
Yes.
Vice Chair McDonald. Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Loeffler.
No.
Representative Allen. Representative Backer. Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hamilton.
Aye.
Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Purcell.
No.
Representative Pearson.
Yes.
Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 7 nays, House File 606 has been re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, members.
Next up, we have House File 1062 with Representative Albright. But before we do that, I do need to clear up one thing that Chair Schumacher is celebrating birthday today. Also, his seatmate, Representative Hamilton, is also celebrating a birthday today. They are going to hug.
Mr. Chair, I thought we discussed House or committee rules earlier in the day, and I know that this was actually part of the subject matter. When two members had a birthday, they actually had to hug.
I believe
on
that.
The same day.
So
Representative Schoen has been studying the rules very closely,
Mr.
and I believe
Chairman,
he is correct.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a big fan of the Kiss Cam.
Thankfully, we are not on TV in the basement of the SWB.
Mr. Chair, I got $5 if you just allow that.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I will move that. Oh, there we go.
Oh, yes.
Representative House Albright, I would like to move that House File 1062 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us, and I believe there's an author's amendment titled A2. Would you like to discuss the A2 amendment, Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, I also have an oral amendment to the amendment that I'd like to provide.
All right. If members could get the A2 amendment in front of them, Representative Albright has a minor oral modification to the amendment. Representative Albright.
This would be on the amendment. It is pertaining to line 1.2. And after the word insert, strike what's actually underlined and insert emergency services as defined in 245.462 subdivision 11 and 245.4871 comma, subdivision 14.
All right. Could you repeat that one more time, Representative Albright, and we'll see if staff can repeat that back for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll actually back the truck up a little bit and make it sound a little more cogent. If you look at the bill itself on line 1.18, this might help clarify what I just gave to you. After parentheses 3, strike everything, and then insert emergency services as defined in 245.462, subdivision 11, and 245.4871, subdivision 14. I'm happy to provide my copy to legal so that they can copy it accordingly.
Ms. Olson, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, I do not. If Representative Albright could say the citations one more time, or if I could look at what he has. Mr. Chair, do you want me to repeat?
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it would be easier if the oral amendment was to strike page 1, line 2 and 3 of the amendment, and then reinsert language. If that would be okay. I could write it out for you.
All right. I'm confused as to what the amendment wants to do, so if we could do that quickly, please.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Not to be difficult, but we do have a 24-hour rule, and so it would be helpful to understand if this is purely technical or what the substance of it is, so I can understand the leniency about the 24-hour rule.
Trying to figure that out myself, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I help you out?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, members, sorry about this. Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. We have been working with the health plans in the Department of Commerce, and so we tried to get the amendment in as soon as possible. The original reference was to 256B, the medical assistance definition of mental health crisis services. They preferred it to be under 245, the Department of Human Services, where they have a more general description of mental health crisis services, but they're both pretty similar, except 256B goes into a lot more detail. And so it's just two different references, and they preferred one over the other. And I was seeking no objections.
Ms. Abderholden, if we were to pass it as is, would that be amenable to work with the department down the road?
Absolutely.
I think that would be my preference.
That's acceptable, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, then we revert back to the bill as it was presented to you without the amendment. And I'll just make my comments brief, Mr. Chair. If you're having a medical emergency, say a heart attack, or you fall and you call 911 in an ambulance response. If you're having a mental health crisis, you call 911 and a police officer responds. With mobile mental health crisis teams, we can have mental health practitioners or professionals respond. Moreover, the outcomes will be much better for those afflicted. Some of you have heard from law enforcement saying that too many people with mental illnesses end up in their jails. The most effective way to prevent this is to have mobile mental health crisis teams so that we can effectively address the mental health crisis that we see in our state and provide stabilization services in a person's own home. There are 13 counties that do have teams and about 34 counties that do have limited availability to those. For those that were in committee just earlier, we heard from Candiota County, or excuse me, Beltrami County, where they are wrestling with this very similar circumstance. This bill will help increase access to crisis services across the state and prevent people from using more costly hospitalized levels of care or ending up in our jails for purposes that they do not need. I have Ms. Abderholden as well as Jill West with me to explain the process and the content of the bill. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Nami, Minnesota. And I know that it's late and everyone is really tired, but I have to say, of the many bills that are before you that deal with the mental health system, this is an extremely important one. And I've heard everyone else's today, too. You know, mental health crisis services really do divert people away from our emergency rooms, from hospitalization, from our jails. Every state across the country is looking at how do we really build up our mental health crisis system. You've heard many people say that we have a logjam in our mental health system. People can't get into the hospital. And what we really have is a front door issue and a back door issue. And, of course, the back door issue comes with our ERTs and our supportive housing, but the front door issue is our crisis system. And it's not just our mobile teams. And if you think about people who are difficult to engage in treatment, you're not going to get them into the emergency room. The mobile teams can go out to where they are, to where they're holed up in their house, or if they're having a crisis at the grocery store, they can go out to them and engage them in treatment. The crisis homes are a wonderful way to actually help stabilize people. We hear from many people who live with a serious mental illness that they are much more willing to go to a crisis home early on when their symptoms return, rather than wait till they get very sicker and go to the emergency room because they're not afraid of being committed. And typically people stay 3 to 5 days. It's not a one-night turnaround, go back to where you are. It's really helping them get stable so that they can return home. And these are far cheaper services than, frankly, ambulances, police driving people, all of those kinds of things. And I know that you're tired, but of all the issues, this is like, this happened to us in the Senate, too. We were there at 10 o'clock at night, and I was just like, but this is really, really important. And I just really want to stress that because this will make a huge, huge difference in our mental health system.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I misspoke. This is May Pitkin rather than Jill West.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dr. Kay Pitkin. I'm manager of emergency mental health services at Hennepin County and a licensed psychologist. I operate mobile crisis teams and contract with a residential provider and also work regionally and across the state to try to improve the quality of crisis services and plan. So I am very enthusiastic about this bill. Just to give you some context, crisis programs have been closing and threatening to close across the state because of financial issues, so this is very critical. One of the pieces of that is the fact that many insurance carriers do not include crisis services as a covered benefit. And because of the nature of the services, they are provided on the spot. There's not time to sort out financial issues on the front end. So oftentimes the teams are stuck holding the bag for the service. It's not covered by insurance. So what we can do is declare this as an emergency service that will be covered in all of the plans across the state. This benefits all of our counties that currently have crisis teams and will benefit also the counties that start to bring up crisis teams over time as grant funds become available. So we're very hopeful that this is going to improve both the access and the quality of the services that we're providing. We really do need a statewide solution for some of these things. We've tried to negotiate and do various things with individual insurance carriers, and it just is not an effective way to do this. We really need to have a consistent approach to this. And to give you a sense of what crisis services do, I know that many of you have heard this before. Maybe some are less familiar, but I think our main focus is to make sure that people can remain in their homes, schools, and communities, and we're very effective at doing that. 80% of the people we come in contact with are able to do that, so it's a very high success rate, very cost-effective. Some of the numbers I've pulled recently for suicidal self-injury and hospitalization costs as compared to crisis costs show a return on investment that is like 400 to 1. So really very very good at saving dollars. And when we look across systems, too, if we're looking at correctional systems, hospitals, and a variety of other systems that pick up the costs for this, it's so much more effective to do this in this way. And there's very high consumer satisfaction with mobile crisis services. We tend to be like 95% satisfaction from the clients that we see. They're very enthusiastic. Constantly, clients are coming to me and saying, if you need any testimony at the legislature, if we can do anything to let people know about the efficacy of these services and what they've done for our families, we'd be happy to do that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of goodwill that occurs as a result of providing this service in addition. Another thing is that we really do focus on keeping people in their homes and communities. We work closely with police and law enforcement to make sure that people are out of that system when they can be. Also, we have discovered that this is an effective way to reach communities that are underserved in the health system in general and in mental health particularly. Stigma plays a role in people's access to mental health services, and so we do a lot to reach out to people in a variety of communities and have effectively increased their access to mental health services. Another major role we play is prevention of suicide and suicidal self-injury, which is devastating to families, as we know, and also has a lot of cost associated with it in the healthcare system. A third of the clients that we see in mobile mental health crisis services are talking about suicide, so it's really clearly an issue for us. We can bring suicide rates down by having this resource in place, and the workers will go out on the bridge and talk to the person who is thinking of ending their life, get them off the bridge, and get them the services they need. So there's situations like that, and then also some situations where we're just keeping people in their homes and tiding them over until help is on the way. And like, for example, there's a 12-year-old who was having psychotic symptoms in his home in the evening, has treatment available during the day, and the crisis worker came out and worked with him and his parents to help him to make it through the night and have a plan to be safe and calm for the remainder of the night and then see the provider the next day. And there was a 26-year-old woman from an underserved community who felt a lot of stigma at accessing mental health services but was feeling racing thoughts and trouble sleeping and worried that she was going to lose her job. The crisis team came out and worked with her to get quick access to psychiatry and a variety of other services, and she was able to keep her job, keep her apartment, and avoid any stigma associated with seeking services because she received the services in her home and then was assisted in getting further services afterwards. So very effective service and high satisfaction going on there. Pennington County provided over 12,000 crisis services during the past year, and that continues to rise. I think demand is untapped at this point in our state, and we need to provide more of this service and have it financed. Let's see, what else? I think that pretty much covers it. I think we're just really looking for better access and higher quality across the board and hope that you will support that.
Thank you, Dr. Pitkin. And we also have Jill West from People Incorporated. Ms. West, please introduce yourself for the testimony and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Committee. My name is Jill West. I'm CEO of People Incorporated Mental Health Services. We've been providing mental health crisis services for nearly two decades in conjunction with Hennepin, Ramsey, and Anoka counties primarily. I'm here today to share a little bit about our real-world experiences with this important work as the committee considers this important legislation. A mental health crisis is potentially a serious situation, just as a severe wound can lead to death if emergency medical treatment isn't immediately provided. A mental health crisis can lead to an individual acting in a way that they wouldn't normally act. Without immediate emergency help, they might, for example, seek suicide as a rational option. Just as we wouldn't expect an individual to be able to snap out of dealing with a broken bone without assistance, we can't expect an individual in mental health crisis to be able to deal with such a significant issue on their own. However, like urgent medical needs, not all urgent situations require inpatient hospitalization. Mobile and crisis mental health services function at the high end of an integrated continuum of care, just as emergency rooms do. The goal for both systems is to prepare individuals for success after the crisis. Our crisis residences, of which we have three, are 16-bed facilities. They are for individuals who experience all different levels of crisis. It can be family crisis, it can be potential self-harm, coping, psychosis. These are home-like environments that are open, where they have access to support, therapy, medication, physician services, and nursing. People Incorporated treats nearly 1,500 individuals a year in our three mental health crisis residences. Each individual's length of stay runs an average of 3 to 10 days. But if you compare the cost of these services to comparable costs of an emergency room and or inpatient hospitalization, which is the only other option available, we save millions of dollars a year to taxpayers and hospitals. Make no mistake, we're already paying for these services. We're just not being efficient about it. Mental health crisis services offer us an opportunity to truly do this work in a better, smarter, less expensive fashion with more dignity and respect offered to the individual in crisis. Thank you for your time, and I hope that you'll consider this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any anybody in the audience who'd like to testify on the bill? Seeing no testifiers, we'll close the testimony portion and go to member questions. The first member question is Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't have a question. I did want to reassure Ms. Abderholden that although our eyes may be weary, that at least from my perspective, I think this is really important legislation as well, and I'm glad that we are hearing this bill. Want to thank Representative Albright for bringing it forward. You made an incredibly important point when you talk about the police showing up to these crises. And when I talk to the police in my community, their number one concern is the fact that they are not equipped and their resources are being diverted to deal with mental health crises, which really belong in a healthcare setting. And people need healthcare in order to a healthcare model in order to treat these crises, not a criminal justice model. And so thank you for doing the work to make that shift. I really appreciate it.
Representative Loeffler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just add to the testifiers. While we hear these terms bandied about, know vaguely what they are, the stories that you tell stay with us. And thank you so much for staying so late to share them with us.
Thank you. Other questions? Ms. Abderholden, I do appreciate you sticking around with us late on deadline week. And this is a very important bill, and it's one of those areas where it's often hard to find areas where there's agreement between the House and the Senate and the governor. This is one of those areas where everybody seems to be focusing, so I think it's very fortuitous and good efforts all the way around, and also I think everybody on the committee has learned a lot this year about this important issue. So last word, Representative Albright.
Members, thank you for your kind consideration of this bill, and I hope that it has generated your support. With that, thank you.
Representative Albright renews. I would like to renew my motion that House File 1062 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 1062 is laid over for possible inclusion. With that, members, we are adjourned.